Hello and welcome to the first episode of RoundPeg Podcast in 2020. I'm your host, Ali Barhani, geostrategy expert with Business Families Foundation and the managing director of 360 Strategic Advisors. Joining me today from Lille, France, is Antoine Maillon, the past board member of Association Familiale Muyer, the current chairman of CREADIEV, the senior advisor to Business Families Foundation, and Association Familiale Muyer is the conglomerate behind many of the brands that we are all familiar with, including Auchan, Decathlon, Leroy Merlin, and many other very good businesses in France and in emerging markets. We will be discussing with Antoine all the intricacies, all the challenges, all the beauties, and all the complexities of a successful multi-generational entrepreneurial family business. Antoine Maillon, welcome to RoundPeg Podcast.
Thank you.
I vividly remember being with you in beautiful Charlevoix back in November at the Families Summit of Minds, and where you perhaps very, how do you say, seamlessly explained the complexities and the beauties of family enterprise and family business for all of us. But for those of our guests who are tuning in and listening to this conversation, I'm just going to make a very brief introduction that you are the chairman of CREADIEV, which is the creative entrepreneurial arm of the family to develop non-family entrepreneurs with the goal to help and develop AFM portfolio, which is something we will talk about. You sit also on the advisory board of Business Families Foundation. And your background is very diverse, but at the same time, very concentrated in and around the family business. By practice, you're an agricultural engineer. And that was an interesting part for me to see that you've spent a great part of your life in countries beyond France, in Morocco, Burkina Faso, and the rest. So how did that agricultural engineering end up and fit into a family business? Take us a bit to the early days, and where was the connection between those preparations at Danone and your practice and in the field into the family business?
Okay, well, I must say that when I was 20, I had sworn to myself never to work for my family. This probably because I was wounded during my childhood. When I saw my father, who was an in-law, who got humiliated two or three times by my mother, even though they were a very united couple, sometimes they shouted at each other. Mm. And I happened to hear my mother say to my father used to be the champ, the CEO and owner of a company which belonged to the Mayo family since Louis XIV,
wow,
the 17th century. And my father happened to bring it to, how do you call it, to a crash, to a, il a fait faillite. He broke down the company. Mm-hmm. He failed the company, and my mother would tell him, well, you failed your company because you didn't manage to diversify. Mm-hmm. When my brothers, the Mullier, went from textile industry to retail, and I saw my father humiliated, and that was probably one of the reasons why, when I was 20, I had sworn to myself never to work for this family. Mm. And I happened, after having worked for farmers and then for Danone, it happened that in the years 90s, the Mullier family went through a very strong crisis, which was a crisis which had to do about trust. Mm-hmm. Our elder founders, you know, when you get old, in the balance between trust and fear, obviously the fear side gets harder, mm-hmm, gets heavier, because one would say that founders, entrepreneurs may too often go from risk-taking pleasure to the fear when they get old to lose what they have created. Mm-hmm. And that was part of my cousins, who were founders of so many businesses. They started to fear, and their fear was expressed by the fact that they would say, our children are not capable, are not able to take over. So they had decided to sell all companies, which is unfortunately very often in families in business. Mm-hmm. And we, with a group of 15 cousins, we decided that this wouldn't be fair. And we went against this decision by having a one-year vision process with a fabulous question, which was, why, what for, and for whom do we want to stay together within the next 20 years? And this was such a fantastic question that I decided to join my family, because I thought that these cousins were pretty meaning-oriented. Mm-hmm. And because obviously this question was about meaning. What for and why did we want to stay together? And so during a whole year, we were meeting once a month, and we decided to go against this decision, and we managed to convince our elder family members not to sell anything. And we went in General Assembly with something about telling them, we want to carry on with the businesses you've launched. We want to go ahead with the same businesses. We want to launch new businesses. We want ourselves as family members to launch new businesses. If possible, for those who want, we will launch these businesses inside the family portfolio, and so on. And we want to get involved as family employees. We want to get involved in the governance, etc.
So let me ask you a couple of questions, Antoine. One is that, which generation were you and your cousins in from a family tree? Second generation, third generation, and who came up with that question? Was it a teamwork, or one of you came up with that question?
Actually, the question was led by the family chairman, who at that time was an in-law. You may know that we insist very much on the key success factor, which is having in-laws as normal shareholders inside the family. He was an in-law, so he was far away from this fear. Mm-hmm. And he told us, well, why wouldn't you? We were all from, I belong to the third generation, but as it is a very large family, I'm one of the youngest between the 63 mm-hmm. cousins. And so most of four generations have the same age as I am. Mm-hmm. So I changed the concept of generation by another word, which is generage, mm-hmm. a new word I invented. I split the family between 20 years. So I belong to the third G, but to the fourth generage. Mm-hmm. So most of these cousins were, in fact, belonged to the fourth generation mm-hmm. and fourth generage mm-hmm. with me.
Do you think the fact that this decision came bottom up, from the children and from the cousins to the body of the family, it was better received and much more stronger than if it would have had come from your father and uncles and the elders to say, you guys have to stay, you cannot go out, the door is locked, get on with it? or we are selling. Do you think this bottom-up process was a factor in success?
Definitely yes. Hmm. Definitely yes. And strangely, we had asked after a one-year process, thinking about this question, we would meet once a month at night. We asked to have a special intervention in the next General Assembly. They gave us 5 minutes and no more. And so we came up, this group of 15, just telling, we want, we want, we want, we want. There were more or less 10 we want. And strangely, the very uncles and fathers who had decided to sell the companies, they had a standing ovation for us. That means that they were very happy to see that their own children had decided they were able, we were able.
All right. Now, in 2025, the group will be 70 years, but the history goes further back than that. One thing that you touched on was that in-laws and, you know, husbands and wives are encouraged to come in. Why do you think that many other families and families of prominence, affluence, or business, perhaps heritage, are always very protective, or I would say sometimes close-minded in involving external family members? What is the metric you guys have taken in embracing them and involving them? And as you said, the previous chairman was a family member. How you've done it successfully?
Well, I think this is a matter of balance between what I call pain and joy. Whenever you choose something, you have to contemplate whether you have more joy than pain in any of your decisions. Obviously, having in-laws on board, it has some pain in case of divorce, for instance. It is always difficult. But there is so many more advantages than disadvantages. And I would apply this to any of our decisions. I think in my family, we were very conscious about the fact that whenever we choose something, you always have advantages and disadvantages. The thing we must choose is where there is just a little bit more advantages than disadvantages. Mm-hmm. And obviously, these choices are a little bit more complex than simple choices. Unfortunately, I must say that many of our families are too much influenced by a consultant who always advise us to choose easy ways, easy things, simple things. When doing business inside a family, it is complex. Mm-hmm. If you do not want to go complex, just do not go family in business.
Now, let me just jump in. When you talk about, you know, divorce as a case in point, has it happened that you had a chairman or a prominent family member as a husband or as a wife who's really doing magnificent with the company and with all the stakeholders and all the associate shareholders, members, but may have a personal divergence with his or her partner who happens to be a family member? And if that divorce takes place, did you guys ask the in-law to thank you very much for all your service, bye-bye? Or are you able to contain those bloodlines with his or her performance as he's delivering?
I'd say it's the second point.
Okay.
He or she will have to quit as a shareholder.
Ah, okay.
Because this is our rule. Okay. We want to stay together inside the same family. And in case this guy or this woman gets married another time, obviously, we will not grant his or her new wife or husband, because there are no more blood link, neither their children. So he or she will have to quit. That's the first thing. But
what if they don't get married again, Antoine?
This is a simple rule.
Okay.
We want to protect the family, so he or she has to quit.
Okay.
But if he or she is involved, let's say, I'll give you an example. 5 years ago in January, we asked one of our cousins who was an in-law and who was a member of the managing committee of one of our biggest business. Mm-hmm. We asked him in January, well, we would like you to become the new chairman of the board. He was very transparent. He told us in January, well, I'm not going very well with my wife. There is a risk for us to divorce. We answered him, we do not care about this. Obviously, you will have to quit as a shareholder, but we would like you to become the best, the closest chairman, I mean, the best, the more family between the non-family members to become a chairman. And it happened that we nominated him in June, 6 months later. That was 3 days after his official divorce announced by the judge. Obviously, he doesn't attend our family assembly. He is still very close to us. The only difficult thing is obviously his former wife doesn't want to meet him too much, so she doesn't attend this very general assembly when he is present. But that's the only thing.
When we talk about the concept of all in all, you know, and everybody in everything, it reminds me of the Three Musketeers, one for all and all for one. How is that managed within the family? And can you elaborate a bit more on the concept?
Yes. Historically, my grandfather and my uncles were very much struck by the so-called social doctrine of the church, which today, by the way, is expanded at all Christian religions, which says, among other things, that all our decisions must be fair and efficient. For us French people, it is a little bit strange because we are very much black or white. We cannot, in our French culture, be black and white, be fair and efficient. So this was a little bit revolutionary. And my family, they were, I'd say, more of an, probably a Northern Europe and American culture. I don't know why. They were very much inspired by this fact of being fair and efficient. In 1955, after my grandparents' death, there were seven brothers and some elder nephews. There were 12. They met to decide what to do. They had the choice about dividing. At that time, there were three companies, dividing the companies between them all, or to stay together. And they eventually decided, after a 3 days seminar, to stay together. They wrote down on the compte rendu, they wrote down so as to do better together than each of us separately. And I think this was a good example of being fair and efficient. It was fair because it allowed non-high potential family members, it allowed non-entrepreneur-minded family members to stay as shareholders. And it was efficient because doing so, we were stronger facing the banks. We were stronger in case of difficult times in one business. The other businesses would help the one which goes through difficult times. It was efficient because I am convinced, and we are convinced, that the wheel turns. What does it mean? If you throw out one of your cousins because he is not efficient, he's not a brilliant businessman, which happens very often, or a cousine, mm-hmm. a lady who has no job, etc., you will have to forget about their children. Mm-hmm. Their children may be very high potential. Mm-hmm. If you fight the mother or the father, no way to get their children involved. Mm-hmm. So by keeping them, that's another reason why I say it is efficient. Let's take my example, Antoine. My father has never been reckoned to be a good businessman because he brought his company to, how do you call it in English? To
bankruptcy.
To bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. And still his children, not only me, but my brothers and sisters, some of my nephews, near nephews, are very much involved today in the business. So this is a good example of being fair and efficient. Mm-hmm. Today, this means that every time one of our younger generations decides to launch his or her business inside the all-in-all, mm-hmm. each one of us will instantaneously become shareholder of this new company. Mm-hmm. Whether it has been launched by a family member or by any outside entrepreneur in whose company we will have invested.
Antoine, you go for a lot of lecturing to family businesses around the world and sharing your success story. How often, how many times you have come across with seeing the same model in other families, and how often do you see they take it up on as a challenge in third, fourth, fifth generation, whatever it may be, to try to emulate and replicate what you have done?
I would say there is nothing to replicate because I think each family must have its own model. To answer your first question, I must say that I met very few families, whether in these conferences or in seminars which I organize for single families mm-hmm. around the world. I usually organize 2-day seminars where I ask all the family to attend the seminar. I must say, I do find some bits of our model. But the strange thing about our model is that we tried so many different things mm-hmm. with rather just a little bit more success than failure. Mm-hmm. Talking about the all-in-all concept, I'm talking about the fact that we are today 850 shareholders, mm-hmm. and that within the next 20 years we will probably be 2,000. I'm talking about the fact of involving every single family member as an employee at the best level for him or for her, mm-hmm. not just to become a senior manager, just to have the opportunity to work inside one of our companies. Mm-hmm. It's about helping next generations launch their own business, but inside a family portfolio. So they're happy about it because they are very autonomous, mm-hmm. but we are happy about it because we get added value from their own business and so on.
I appreciate that you say certain families have to have their own models, but many of the things you have embedded in AFM, Association Familiale Muet, are like core muscles that, you know, hold the body together in more ways than one. So one would think it's like a family business gym program, that if you don't develop those muscles, you cannot go places. So I agree with you that a biceps in this business, or I don't know, legs in the other business may be stronger or different, but I am struggling as to why they haven't been more efforts from other family businesses to look at some of these exercises and practices and try to do that. But question for you, when you say that, you know, when you ask a cousin to leave his or her son, maybe the most brightest, in a sense, you guys are, as a family, banking on a consolidated balance sheet of courage, intelligence, entrepreneurship on every branch of the family. Would that be the right way of putting it? And saying that way we're stronger, you know, the root is stronger.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And I may give you five arguments to try to convince those who are not convinced. Mm-hmm. I'm convinced that the fact of helping every generation mm-hmm. launch new businesses, this is the key success factor for longevity. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, what happens? You know very well this say, which says that first generation creates, mm-hmm. the second generation is asked by the first not to take any more risks because mm-hmm. the first generation doesn't want to blow up all they have created. And the third generation, having seen their parents just managing without taking risks, they think business is easy mm-hmm. and they will subcontract the management of their businesses mm-hmm. outsiders, and they will go to the Bahamas. I think if you keep this muscle of helping generation after generation to know what is risk taking, what is not sleeping very well at night because your bank is telling you you're not going very well, and they may cut the tap mm-hmm. of cash, and etc. This is the best muscle to keep family members alive. Mm-hmm. And there is another reason why it is important, is that it allows next gen not to live under the shade of their parents. Mm-hmm. The biggest risk for next gen is to live under the shade of a huge founder, the son or the daughter, either will just go absolutely opposite of his father or mother, or he will or she will reproduce exactly what his or her parents have done. And both are bad. That's why if we help them launch their own business where they will take their own risks. They will learn how to grow together with their business instead of inheriting a huge business. Mm-hmm. I think this is the best muscle you can give to a family.
So you have, within this 850 family members, you have associate members, which are then the husbands and wives. Then you have the intrapreneur family members who start their new businesses. Who are the mentor members? How many mentors are in that circle? And I want to interlude another question to that. Did your father have a mentor or not? And from his perhaps challenges, did you learn anything that's not just by the fact of staying in the family, that, hey, I need a mentor?
Definitely, yes. My father had no mentor. Mm. And our mentors, we tend to use our governance as a mentor organization. Mm-hmm. We have a very strict governance which says, if you launch a new business, before having the first euro of turnover, it is compulsory for you to set up a board of at least three board members whom you will meet every 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
On a mentorship attitude, I call it a mirror attitude or a midwife attitude. Mirror, because it's the best way for an entrepreneur to look at himself or at herself inside the mirror and say, well, I'm well, my hair are okay, my eyes are okay, and so on, or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the other attitude of these mentor is obviously the midwife attitude, because these boards are not to decide for the entrepreneur. They are only to help the entrepreneur to, what's the English word, to bring to birth
mm-hmm.
their babies.
To deliver the baby, yeah.
To deliver the baby, mm-hmm. which is all the decisions they have to deliver.
And they have to be family members, these three, or they can be outsiders as well?
No, they must be diverse.
They must be diverse, okay.
Yes, and we have three sources of diversity. The first one is at least one-third would be family members.
Mm-hmm.
Another third would be experts in the very business.
Mm-hmm.
And the third would be completely outside people.
Mm-hmm. When we met in Charlevoix and you were talking so passionately about you attending and going around the world, making the calls, I called you as a chief healing officer, if you remember. and your title became the CHO. Family business is a tough business, you know. On one side, you have to give the dose of medicine. On the other side, you have to give the love. It's like oil and vinegar. If it's very well shaken, it's a good, how do you say, dressing. But if not, it separates. How do you go from benevolence and hard decisions? How do you manage that within the family?
Well, I love your idea of the vinegar and oil sauce. If you agree, I will take it for me too.
Please.
Vinegar and oil. And oh, yes, that's beautiful. Many people call me the CEO. That is the chief emotional officer.
Well, I call you chief healing officer.
Yes, it's a little bit the same. Obviously, that's the most difficult thing to deal with and inside a family and business. And I must say that having a business inside a family, it's just unnatural. It shouldn't happen
mm-hmm.
because family is about emotions. It's about love and hate. And business is about figures and rationalizing everything. So to deal with both of them, I think this is a huge issue. And we try, perhaps, probably just a little bit better than others,
Mm-hmm.
We try to manage these two, what I call the two horses. The horse of the family, the horse of the emotions, the horse of, and the other horse, which is the horse of business performance.
Mm-hmm.
The aim of this is that the furrow is straight if the two horses go at the same speed.
Mm-hmm.
This is a plateau, say,
mm-hmm.
which I integrated for me. And this, there is no scientific solution for this. It's just a matter of what I did. I insisted very, very much on private interviews. That is, every year,
mm-hmm.
I had decided to meet 100 of my cousins every year in an eye-to-eye interview. I think this is part of the best ways to manage these two horses.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because when I go and see one of my nephews or nieces, the first purpose of my going to him or to her. I will never ask him or her to come to my office. I would go to his or her house, whether she lives in Canada, in China, in Spain, in South America, I would go to her house. What's the first purpose? The first purpose is to tell him or her, you are important for us. Mm-hmm. You are important for us. Whether you are a brilliant business woman or man, or whether you just nobody for the business, mm-hmm. you are important for us. And then the other purpose, obviously, of this private interview is to try to check, so how are you doing with the family? What do you think of our mm-hmm. strategy? Would you like to contribute in a way or another, even mm-hmm. if you're just a teacher or whatever? I think this is because it's a way to prevent from something which happens very much in families. Well, I do not exist. I'm nothing. To these entrepreneurs, to these fantastic fellows who have launched so beautiful businesses, and I am nothing. I do not exist.
I totally agree with you, and I think a lot of times it boils down to relevance, you know? And when people feel that they are not relevant to a body, they get into atrophy, you know, and that atrophy brings a great deal of problems.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
There is a very fine gentleman, a wizard in management, in creating things, and as an author, you may have heard of him. His name is Charles Handy. And he has a book called The Second Curve, which is always about breaking away, creating a new trajectory in the height mm-hmm. and in peak of your growth, not when you're down. You know, to separate from success in order to create something new is very important. So how often, you know, with this new generation of entrepreneurs, they have the interventions embedded in them, induced in them, because you're the midwife, and how often you disrupt their businesses, or they're doing it themselves, or you allow it for the market to take that role?
I'd say it's a mix of the three. I must say we're not very good. We are good, but not very good at helping existing businesses to innovate. Mm. Very often we do it a little bit too late when the businesses exist. That's one of our key issues today with our Auchan hypermarket company, mm-hmm. which has probably lived too freely inside their success, mm-hmm. and not enough people have shouted at them, watch out, times are getting harder, you must, even if you are still in success, you must start changing your business model. Mm-hmm. We are much better in another way, which is through new businesses. Mm-hmm. I think our core competences are better to accompany new entrepreneurs in their new businesses. And obviously, we just have to accompany their own innovation, you see, mm-hmm. starting small. For us, I think it's a little bit more difficult. Apart from, luckily, two of our major companies, Decathlon and Leroy Merlin, I think they manage to innovate even when they are in good times.
Mm-hmm. But when I listen to you in terms of the perhaps being sometimes late in change, it seems that your father as well had the same challenge, you know, so he didn't change and he didn't reinvent.
No.
So elaborate on that, because I for a moment I felt like, okay, the old man didn't create something new and he didn't change. So why to hold a grudge against him if Auchan is still doing the same, you know? How do you differentiate that? In different time, in different scale. just being a bit provocative. So challenge me on that.
Yes. I think, first of all, my father had no mentor. That was my answer when you put this question.
Yeah.
He had no board. Mm-hmm. And I'm absolutely convinced that the duty of any board, acting as a mirror, is to be an increasing mirror. You know, you have three types of mirror, the flat one, the increasing one, and the lowering one.
Yes.
I want my board members to be increasing mirrors. They must increase two things. When things are going wrong, they must increase these small pieces of a blue sky, which are above our head, and telling the entrepreneur, look out. You have problems now, but look ahead. Look at this little bit of a blue sky, which is growing. Mm-hmm. We call it being, I don't know the English word because there is no English word. We say bienveillant, that is being caring when things go wrong. Mm-hmm. And on the contrary, I ask the board members when things are going very well, to be more exacting, because at that time, the mission of the board members is to identify the weak signals indicating difficult times for the next years, because no entrepreneur can identify these weak signals when he is in success. Mm-hmm. At that time, it's the mission of the board. Mm-hmm. And if I come back to Auchan, I think the Auchan board was a little bit too weak. Mm-hmm. None of them would have had enough courage when the times were good to say, watch out, internet is coming, watch out, Center City. Retail is coming. Mm-hmm. Watch out, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm. So, would it be fair to sum up the three weakest links in a family business, from what I have learned from you, an Achilles heel of a family business, in not having mentors, in not having a strong board, in keeping the next gen too close, too tight, leashed, and a fear? Would these four or three be the sum up, or would you be able to, as always, share a little bit more nuggets about the weakest links for a family business?
Say it again. Not so, having a board.
Not having a strong board to challenge you and to give you hope.
Yes.
I think somebody asked Barack Obama, how is it like to live with Michelle Obama, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I remember, yes.
Yeah, and he said, with Michelle, no high is too high and no low is too low.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes a good board has the same, you know, responsibility.
Not having a strong board, I agree.
A good mentor. You know, not just mentors as a board, but separate mentors for, you know, personal issues, because so many things you may not be able to take to the board. And perhaps I would say ability to allow the next gen to go in and out of the family, you know, not to cage
not
them.
Allowing next gen.
And then calling disruptors to come in, you know, not consultants, but people with creative strategic orientation who come and give you a bit of a stretch in the thinking beyond what even just the board says, because the board as well are very much at times focused on the core business. So bringing people from other practices to challenge you.
I definitely agree with these three things. Not having a strong board, that's this is part of these weak points. Not having a mentor, definitely. Not allowing next gen to go in and out. That means to be allowed to sell or buy shares and to create in or out of the family portfolio. Mm. Not having creative advisors. This is a key point I've been discovering for the last 10 years. Whenever we don't have inside our different boards this particular guy or woman whom we call a creative minded person. Things usually do not go as innovative as they should go. And today we try to put inside the board, whether a family member, whether an outsider, we try to put these creative people. I would add another one, obviously, you won't be surprised, not having in-laws.
Mm-hmm.
Because in-laws, they bring in five key success factors.
Mm-hmm.
First, they bring innovations because they haven't been brought up inside the core business. They mm-hmm. come from outside. They bring in temperance because they haven't fought with their brothers and sisters or cousins when they were children at the grandparents' home or at the parents' home. So there is no jealousy between the in-laws and the rest of the family.
Mm-hmm.
They bring in their competence. Strangely, as I told you, in the years 90s, the family chairman was an in-law. Today, the family chairman has been an in-law mm-hmm. since the last 6 years. And there is another reason why. Talking about children's education, both members of the couple will transmit their love about the business.
Mm-hmm.
When if only one of the two is a shareholder, the father would answer his children, well, go and see your mother, I'm not a shareholder, or go and see your father, I'm not a shareholder.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them will transmit this passion.
That's extremely wise. Now, when I look at the Catalan sales, roughly, I mean, you know, it's around $15 billion, up, give or take. I don't know. No need to zoom in on those. That's the GDP of Georgia in CIS and Central Asia. Auchan's around $55 billion. That equals the GDP of Tanzania. And I assume if you add those up and other businesses, the group turnover is roughly around the GDP of Morocco, where you started your engineering career. Would you agree that some families are better governed than many countries and run by many other countries? And in that follow-up, is there more family businesses and that sense of stewardship missing in the politics and in government today? Is there a role for family businesses to be more prominent? Or do you think these two have to be completely separate?
I think... Two things.
Okay.
Your first question, I do think some families in business organizations are better organized than states,
mm-hmm.
mostly because of this mentorship issue.
Mm-hmm.
I would love, and probably Barack Obama had his own board, which was Michel.
Mm-hmm.
Probably our French present president has also his wife,
mm-hmm.
who is 20 years older than him, mm-hmm. and I think she is a wise woman.
Mm-hmm.
Too many politicians do not have this mentor, whether a private board or a coach or what we could call a counterpower.
Mm-hmm.
A counterpower. I think this is very important. To your second question, I would say watch out. I think you must not put too many powers into the same hands,
mm-hmm.
because this may lead to dictators, you say?
Yes, dictators, correct.
When the government himself belongs to families in business or is very close to families in business, I think there's a big risk of conflict of interest, because too many interests are aligned. The same with, I do not agree when families in business buy papers, because I think papers must be free mm-hmm. of any economical influence and so on. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this was your question.
No, I think you touched on a very, very important thing, that, you know, that marriage or that flirting between family businesses and government should be avoided. Totally agree. And on your point about some of the newspapers having been bought by tycoons and family businesses, I couldn't agree more. What I meant was that that values those sense of stewardship, that long-termism, that sense of disruption, creation, and entrepreneurship that has been brewed within family members. Would you think that some of the family members would be better politicians, not to marry the two? That wasn't my point. So from time to time, from families, from prominence, with the right moral compass, they could end up in politics and take many of those learnings into running a state. That was my point, not to marry the two.
I would also be cautious, or at least I would extend your proposal to any business manager, not only family. I would be cautious, because let's say, if a Moulier starts going politics, obviously he will be accused by the opposition. Well, you are a family member, you are a wealthy person, and probably you will not be completely free of personal interest. I mean, it's just a caution. It can be, but this man or this woman must be extremely clear about which hat he is wearing when he is talking. Mm-hmm. Is it the government hat? Is it the shareholder's hat? Is it the business hat? Is it, you see, he or she must be a little bit schizophrenic. He must accept to be schizophrenic.
Okay. Now, you closely collaborate with Business Families Foundation. What do you think is the role of think tanks like BFF in betterment of future of family businesses, other than just bringing all of us together, people like yourself, peers? What do you think is the secret sauce for a success of some of these think tanks, Campden, BFF, and others? What are your suggestions there?
First of all, I would make a difference between BFF and Campden, because Campden is more like a profit organization, when BFF is a non-profit. I think it's important for these think tanks to be non-profit, mm-hmm. first of all. Even if I appreciate Campden and other profit organizations making, gathering family families in business. And then I think that the purpose of BFF, whether BFF or FBN or any non-profit organization, I think it's indeed to gather, to make families in business meet together, exchange best practices, bring in theoretical learnings and so on. I mean, what BFF is doing, I think it's great. It's just helping families in business get new ideas, get to know that their own problems, they can share them with other families who have exactly the same problems, the same issues, and so on.
So we wouldn't be able to talk about business, family business, and without taking into consideration the changing world we live in. Many retailers have gone to China, from Amazon, Carrefour, Tesco. Everybody walked away. Everybody dropped the gauntlet and said, thank you, we can't do business, and walked away. You have been there. You have been thriving. What is the success kernel in terms of what you have done in China? Is it in the partnership because, you know, you went into collaboration with Alibaba and Sun Art Retail Group? Or is it taking many of the long-termism that you've had for growth, even in a market like China? What is the story there?
Wherever we go, we always go on a long-term perspective. Mm-hmm. That's our key decision-making issue. Afterwards, in the real world, when we went to China, for instance, when Auchan went to China, it was on a real, on a true long-term perspective, mm-hmm. association with a family from Taiwan. And after other things, other threats, other opportunities eventually occurred, which made it almost compulsory for us to find a continental partner. Mm-hmm. Moreover, who was very good at internet, Alibaba. But there is no change as for our general purpose, which is to be on a long-term position.
Mm-hmm. So in France, I know that you keep part of the shares for the employees, right? Like around 15 or 20%. I think you touched on that, something of that
yes.
effect. When you go to an overseas market, is that model replicated and maintained, or you play by the rules of the game in that country?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Even if it's a little bit more complex, because there is no incitation, is it in English? But there is no incitation when in France, when you save some money from your personal saving, you are free of tax if you put it in your own company's shareholding program. Mm-hmm. So outside, it's a little bit more difficult, but we do launch employees' shareholding everywhere in the world. In China, if I remember, employees' shareholding was launched, I think, 6 or 7 years ago, probably 10 years ago. I don't remember. Mm-hmm. It needed some criteria on which we are very strict. First criteria is that every single employee must have had the opportunity of an economic teaching, mm-hmm. Learning about what is a balance sheet, what is a
financial literacy, you basically.
Finance training. Mm-hmm. Every single employee must have a finance training, because shareholding is another example about being fair and efficient. Mm-hmm. It is fair, obviously, because it allows employees to benefit from the added value created by themselves, by the way. And it is efficient because, obviously, one rules better something you own than something which belongs to somebody else. Mm-hmm. We always noticed. So, and the fact that they have a finance course will help them understand the connection between the share value and their own action, mm-hmm. their own work.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. You are, very eloquently talking about your approach to China. Many of the businesses in China, including your partners, Alibaba and the rest, are entrepreneurs in their first gen, When you talk to them, how hungry, how keen, and how open they are in developing constitutions, governance, learning, and developing something bigger than themselves for future generations. Because my experience has been that at times the first founder is so full of energy and drive, and at times one would say a bit of ego, that I did it, so what do you have to tell me and to teach me? Or do you see a difference in reception, in learning, and hunger for learning from family businesses in Asia Pacific? I'm not talking about Hong Kong, China, and Europe.
I don't see any difference because what you told about the ego and so on, I think this is universal. It comes from any founder wherever he lives, and I've been paid for this. I paid for this to try to manage our founders, which is a bit of an issue, I can tell you. Mm-hmm. So this is worldwide. I notice that Eastern Asia founders are quicker in learning from our best practices in terms of succession planning. I notice, I don't know about Alibaba because I don't know him, but I can tell you that some of our Decathlon producing partners in China, they have become partners of Decathlon in the 70s. They are all becoming entering their retiring phase, and they are all worried about what they will do with their children. Mm-hmm. And most of them ask us advice about how to deal with their children, how to manage their succession planning, and so on.
That's amazing. I couldn't simply get enough of talking to you, Antoine, in person, over a podcast. Thank you for tuning in all the way from France today. For me, listening to the story of Association Familiale Mouillet and your journey is a deep dive in how family businesses function. But you are, at the end of the day, in business of retail, and today I felt that I have been in a retail shop of wisdom, going from aisle to aisle and shelf to shelf and picking up a lot of good things. And one thing I can assure you, despite your policy for exchange and return, I'm neither going to exchange them with you nor return them to you, but I will share them with other people, the guests who will tune into us. And I'm sure I will come back to this conversation hopefully soon in another session. So thank you very much for joining me.
Okay. I would just add as a conclusion two things.
Please.
Do not forget, because when I speak, people might think this is easy and they're very lucky. Let's not forget this is hard work. This needs patience. And this needs to be convinced that even if we went through so many difficult times in the past, we still have difficult times today, and we will have to face difficult times tomorrow. This is not an easy way, and this is very fragile. Mm-hmm. Let us not think it is easy and strongly consolidated. All this is fragile and needs courage, hard work, and perseverance.
And love.
And love, absolutely.
On that note, thank you very much, Antoine. I'm sure we will have you back on Brown Peg Podcast very soon. I immensely enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, Ali.